Well, good day, and welcome to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is Pete North, better known by the successful ex-handle Northern Variant, who is involved in policy development for the newly established UK Homeland Party. Today we discuss what the UK Homeland Party is and why it is needed, how it differs from Nigel Farage's Reform Party and the UK Conservative Party, why, in his view, it is not possible to change the existing UK political parties in a way that takes immigration and national identity concerns seriously, the practical problems with remigration and deportations and how they might be achieved, and his recommendations for Australia, and much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, Pete North, welcome to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Hello.
Yeah, good to make the connection, and thanks for coming on. For people in Australia and elsewhere in the world who aren't familiar with you, you post under a Twitter handle, X handle, Northern Variant, and yep. You come at things from a nationalist perspective, I guess, broadly defined, and you're very articulate, and you've also been involved in party politics at various levels. And now you've joined something called the Homeland Party. What is the Homeland Party in the UK, and why do you think it's needed?
Well, it's a new party, and it's a purebred nationalist party. And I think it's needed because you're probably aware of Nigel Farage's Reform and the rise of that movement. But that owes its heritage to the Eurosceptic movement that goes right back to the early 90s. It built up through winning seats in the European Parliament and then became something of a national force in British politics around 2014, and actually was pivotal in leveraging the EU referendum that saw us leaving the EU. Now, this is a very particular constituency of boomers. They tend to be civic nationalists, and they are absolutely marinated in the dogma that Nigel Farage likes to trot out, which is, we don't care about skin colour, religion, and blah, blah, blah. All the classic 90s tropes. And these are all ideas that I personally believed in myself right to the core. But actually, it's becoming the case now that after Boris Johnson and his disastrous, we're calling it the Boris wave, of just unlimited immigration from all over the world. And so while we're marinated in this dogma of colorblind meritocracy, as is now fashionable to call it, we're seeing a rise of sectarianism from ethnic minority groups, particularly the Muslim votes. And they are pushing their own ethnic interests. And so the norms of what we call civic nationalism, where, nothing matters so long as our British values are maintained. Well, these British values, they don't exist. Nobody can define them. And everyone says, oh, well, you know, we need policies to stimulate integration. Well, I personally cannot point to many examples of successful integration, because what we have in Britain is ghettoization. There are Muslim areas. There are we have an Eritrean community. We have a Somalian community in Liverpool. You'll have your citizens of nowhere who will integrate into the sort of academic elites, political think tankery, and but it's a fraction. As a whole, generally speaking, this integration we were promised, this 90s notion of the great melting pot, it simply doesn't exist. And so my thinking kind of evolved to realize that these so-called British values that we're all supposed to buy in, they are, in fact, a product of who we are that's evolved over the last 1,000 years. These are values that are derivative of our civilization, which is intrinsically linked with English, Irish, Welsh, and Scottish ethnicity. So these are transient ideas. What this country is very much linked to who we are. And if that is to survive, then it's contingent on us as a people surviving. And looking at the statistics, you know, we're told that the great replacement is this far right conspiracy theory. But it's a matter of statistical fact, and so I want my own people to survive. I want my country to survive, and you know, during all this time, we were told we'd be enriched by diversity. Well, that's clearly not the case. With you know this idea that immigration was going to strengthen and augment us. You know, that might well have been true through the 1990s and beyond, but it's not augmentation when you're reaching replacement levels, because, you know, in 50 years of this levels of immigration without remigration, then we cease to exist. Nothing is being augmented. It's just pure replacement. And so this settled vision of what we call civic nationalism is this neoliberal idea that our country is just this grazing strip. It doesn't matter who occupies it, and just so long as they obey the basic set of laws and pay their taxes, then nothing else matters. So our party, the Homeland Party, well, the clue is in the name. We want to govern the country as though it were a homeland and not just an economic jurisdiction.
Yeah. I mean, these debates are now live ones, not only in Europe, but in the United States and Australia and other parts of the world. But they are still considered the identitarian position or ethno-nationalist position, which which I think is correct to characterize you advocating, is shunned by the major parties, right? Have you had any success? I think were you in the Conservative Party at one stage or you were involved with it? Or have you had any success with either Reform or the Conservative Party in trying to persuade people? Because what you're advocating actually would have not seemed that crazy a position to a Britain 50 years ago. You know, Winston Churchill wrote books called This Island Race and, you know, had a lot of stuff about, you know, stock and representation, the institutions flowing out of, you know, our people. So has it not been possible to persuade some of the other parties that have emerged? And why do you think that is the case, if so?
Well, you're right. In the 50 years ago, this would be a completely normal conversation to have, even on the left. But as we, and actually, it's part of the post-war political dogma that conflated nationalism with imperialism, and of course, nationalism is then associated with Nazism, but of course nationalism is nothing to do with Adolf Hitler's German imperialism. But once they successfully made that connection, it's part of Britain's core post-war identity to take pride in its defeat of fascism. And so, and of course, then there was the trend for internationalism, European Union, effectively the abolition of nation states. And so we're dealing with a generation of people who've been taught to find the concept of nationalism distasteful, and we've had this subversive left-wing indoctrination where we're supposed to hate our country and its achievements. And so Nigel Farage's Reform Party, it's an evolution of the United Kingdom Independence Party, which was set up to leave the EU. And when it existed in its early years, it was very important for the party to disambiguate itself from the then British Nationalist Party, which was it was an ethno-nationalist party with sort of neo-Nazi roots, or there was certainly a lot of that on the fringes. And so Farage adopted the sort of civic nationalist shtick to disambiguate and keep a cordon sanitaire between the cause of national independence from the EU from the sort of grubby end of ethno-nationalism. And I agree that was necessary, but Farage is yesterday's man, and he's never updated his thinking to really internalized what's happening, that we are not only statistically being transformed into something else. You can see it on the streets of London. Not just London, you see it everywhere now. It's not just London. It's not just the big cities like Birmingham and Manchester. And it's not even, you know, the little towns were lost years ago, the post-industrial towns. Bradford, where I'm from, will soon be a majority Muslim country, and most of its representatives will be Muslim, and they will be representing Muslim interests. We just had a story yesterday where a gaggle of RMPs lobbying government to have an airport built in a back end province of Pakistan, and this is nothing to do with us. This is the new sectarianism that's emerging, where the idea that MPs are supposed to represent all of their constituencies just gone out of the window, and we're into this third world tribalism where winner takes all, and this is then a numbers game. So soon those British values, as soon as we become the minority, British values are defined by whoever is the majority. So reform is still stuck in this time warp of believing that it has to sanitize itself, and in many ways has gone to the left of the current Conservative Party, which is starting to wake up to the fact that its core mistake, the reason it is now in opposition, is because it categorically failed on immigration. And if they want to win back public trust, they've got to learn to speak our language. But of course, they kicked out the leadership and installed Kemi Badenoch, who is again one of these elite citizens of nowhere. She describes herself as a first generation immigrant. She is a Nigerian, and though she's learned to speak the language of civic nationalism, she's being outflanked by Robert Jenrick, who lost the last leadership election. But if you look at his social media content, his Tory leadership campaign never ended. And it's turning out that Kemi Badenoch, she's just not very good at politics. She's actually, on a personal level, I actually really like the lady. This is nothing personal. She's just the wrong person for the wrong time. She isn't good at what she does, and she's not saying the right things. Whereas Robert Jenrick is he's now to the right of Nigel Farage. This is the direction the Tory party will eventually go in. But we need, this is why I'm in the Homeland Party, because we are building the case not just for a more ethnocentric nationalism, but we are building the case for remigration, which is essentially policies to encourage emigration. This is return migration. And so we're popularizing those ideas in the hope that they will be adopted by the mainstream of politics.
Yeah, I'm struck in the UK how the language has changed by senior figures in the Conservative Party, which I know you say is unsatisfactory, but it's still well beyond what is possible in Australia. I mean, talk of zero migration or moving to migration in the tens of thousands. I know people are cynical about that, given the promises that have been made in the past and been unfulfilled. But there is no one outside One Nation, which potentially we'll come to later, who have said anything like that amongst the two major parties. There's nothing like Marco Rubio's recent statement, which said that the age of mass migration is over. That just seems well beyond the Overton window here in Australia. So, I mean, at least the senior people are talking about it there. Do you think there's a possibility, at least, either from people within the inside of the Conservative Party or from outside pressure, that they will ultimately move, further in that direction?
It's difficult to say because the number one rule in British politics is to never trust a Tory. The second rule of British politics is to always follow the first rule, because this is a party that has become thing that it's adept at is self-preservation. And so if it needs to say all of these things in order to survive, it very much will. But the moment it gets into office, it becomes a completely different animal. So, Robert Jenrick can tickle our fancy. But it should be recalled that it's still a liberal party. The membership is liberal. The membership are the people who put Kemi Badenoch where she is, and so it's still very much in the domain of a Lib Dem party. And it's whether they have the good sense to actually do what they've promised. But nobody believes it. Because whatever leadership you put in, whatever policies they try to implement is all contingent on party unity. And what we're seeing is that whenever the Conservative Party wins, it is this dysfunctional coalition of free marketeers, libertarians, and liberals. And so they are way behind the curve in that they've recognized that, oh, something must be done about immigration, sure. This is where they're the same as Reform. They're talking about, we will bring immigration numbers right down. And I'm not interested in that, to be honest, because, all right, we need to stop the influx. But that doesn't even begin to address the issues of rising sectarianism and the demographic vandalism that's been done in the last 20 to 30 years. And what it's going to take is quite radical policies to reverse an extreme policy of mass migration. And what we hear from the likes of Farage and Kemi Badenoch is this chatter about integration and we need to end multiculturalism. And these are all things that sound superficially good in this sort of civic nationalist framework, that everybody has the same values and we don't want ghettoization. Everybody agrees on that. But when you start thinking in terms of actual policy, how do you get what you're talking about? Then you're talking about some pretty muscular civic nationalism that shuts down chain migration, shuts down extremist mosques, cancels translation services in the NHS, creates this hostile environment for immigrant communities who want to live separately. But human nature being what it is, they will always find a way to live separately. And how do you integrate third world communities who think in a completely different way? How do you integrate Somalians and Eritreans that are currently on the streets battling each other over things like Eritrean independence? And the more you pick it apart and the more you put it under the microscope, these tropes, these civic nationalist tropes about integration, they just don't stack up. And there's only one real answer to this, and that is to send them back, basically. We can't be having a situation where if war breaks out over Kashmir and there's fighting between Indians and Pakistanis, then we will see that violence breaking out on the streets of Leicester and on the streets of Bradford and northern mill towns. We can't have Bangladeshis having civil wars on the streets of Whitechapel. That you cannot integrate that. More to the point, this is not even skilled migration. This is not anything that that augments or contributes to our economy. This is a peasant class that can only perform basic functions like the Deliveroo economy, this is actually quite dangerous because we've got a political elite that's taking us down the road of net zero, exporting jobs to China, shutting down our steel mills and our factories, making energy more expensive. And that means the British middle class is shrinking, has less disposable income. And if they have less disposable income, they're not buying Deliveroo services. They're not going out in Ubers. There just simply isn't the money to sustain this low skill service economy that runs on immigration. So what they're then going to have to do is turn to organized crime. And I genuinely believe, because this is what happens when you've got a surplus of unemployable, low IQ men, and it is mostly men, you first get the crime waves and then you get law and order disintegrating. Basic conventions of high trust society just evaporate, and pretty soon your cities become demilitarized zones. And, you know, I talk about civil war and people say, oh, Pete, you're exaggerating. But it depends on what you define by civil war. Civil war doesn't necessarily mean tanks on the streets. It just means low-level conflict where, you know, during the day, people might still go to work, the economy still ticks over, but once everybody's gone home at the end of the day, the cities become demilitarized zones where you send armored police Land Rovers in, they get set on fire, and you find that the writ of the government and the power of the state just doesn't reach into foreign enclaves. So we are unable to enforce this rule of law that's meant to underpin this civic nationalism. And then you've got social balkanization, Lebanonization, if you like, but it's disorder. And there's only real one solution to that, and that's to start deporting on a massive scale. And this is, people say, oh, well, you know, that's really extreme. Well, not if you consider the alternatives. And we're not the extremists. The people who are the extremists are the people who did this to us in the first place.
I'll come to the deportation things, because that's probably most controversial, and I'd be interested in the specifics of that. But On the party side of things, because it's all very well having good discussions online, but I'm always interested in how you actually implement solutions at a practical level and get in control of, you know, the levers of government, because that's where real change can actually occur. Yeah. You mentioned the BNP in the past. How does Homeland differ from those guys? And how do you, when you set up an independent party, ensure, for want of a better term, quality control, so that you, because the existing parties, for all their faults, do have the nice sort of middle of the road types who hand out, you know, pamphlets and do all that needs to be done, where setting up a new party tends to attract people with, you know, fervor and the rest of it, and aren't always great at, I don't know, running effective branch meetings and passing resolutions and building up manifestos like you have in the UK. So what gives you hope that Homeland will be able to do that where possibly others have failed?
Well, as I said before, what exists now is this sort of reform party under Farage, which is an evolution of UKIP, which spoke to a very particular demographic who are now quite old now. And if you look at reform party conferences and rallies, you will see it's a sea of white hair and bald hair. And this is the older demographic who are absolutely marinated in what we call Spitfire nationalism, which is very much contaminated with 90s multicultural dogma, which is why Farage won't go as far as need be. And what we're seeing is this sort of civil war for ownership of that demographic and of that political constituency that was originally built up by UKIP. What we're seeing is that that ideology, it's good as far as it goes, but it's not going to work. It's going to require something more robust. So we actually centered on nationalism as an ideology, ditching all of these center-right concepts and moving away from... because it always was a sort of conservative Tory kind of movement. We're a purebred nationalist party, but we're not going to try and battle for the same old constituency built up by UKIP, not least because in 10, 15 years, most of them will be dead, sadly. So we need to actually build up a new constituency. And this is what the party's doing. We set upon a brand of sensible nationalism. And one thing you notice at a homeland party meeting or conference, it is a much younger constituency. And so we're going to develop our own people. We're not going to sit around waiting for a millionaire that's going to come and set up a new organization and backfill it. We're going to build it from the grassroots, one person at a time. We're careful about who we recruit. We've got some mavericks, but that goes with the territory. But I'm involved in developing policy, and the one thing that I've been seriously impressed by is the caliber of people that it's attracting in terms of developing the intellectual product. So we're developing local foundations, an intellectual foundation, and we've got a guiding philosophy. And it's by having these building blocks in place, we're going to attract more like-minded people who are questioning the narrative, and they recognize the need for sensible nationalism that isn't like the nationalism of yore, which was attached to sort of movements like National Front. And before in the 80s, that kind of nationalism, it came from a different place. But what we're finding is we've got some real thinkers on our side now. We've got some good writers, some excellent campaigners, persuasive, motivated people. And it's not, it isn't the skinheads and bother boys of the early 1980s and late 70s, sort of disaffected youth. These are smart, capable people. And that is the foundation upon which I believe we will succeed.
Mm. Yeah. And one more question on party politics. You don't think it's possible for Reform and Nigel Farage to tack more in your direction? He's an articulate performer, right, Nigel Farage? He has been, as an individual, somewhat of consequence. I mean, Brexit was wasn't nothing to get out of the European Union, and it was certainly portrayed as something that was impossible for a long period of time. And as a new party trying to establish himself is not, you know, has the same challenges that any new party has in trying to establish themselves beyond its initial core constituency. You don't think in due course he'll just be adept enough to be able to move more in a direction that you think is necessary?
No. No, Farage is a showman. He is not a competent politician, and he's not an effective leader. And he's left this, throughout his career, he's left this trail of wreckage, of fallouts. And so UKIP nearly split two or three times, and it's produced a number of offshoots along the way. And this latest row with Rupert Lowe, this is classic Farage. And he's a man out of time, as I say. You know, he was programmed in the 1990s. He developed his politics over the next 20 years. He is yesterday's man. He's running on obsolete software, and he is he's always going to see anything much more fervently nationalist and based on sort of ethnocentric politics. He's always going to see that as far right, and he won't touch it with a barge pole because he himself doesn't want to be tainted with any of that. He wants to keep it in the center right and develop it from there. But what you notice about Reform, well, Reform isn't a new party. It's just a natural evolution from what UKIP was. Mm-hmm. And it's a populist party. It doesn't have any policies. It doesn't have any guiding philosophy. It doesn't have an intellectual definition. And it will say anything at any time, depending on what the focus groups are telling him. And so he's moving the party closer to the center without realizing that he's losing most of his base. His activist base is turning away from him. The blogosphere and YouTubers, they're all saying, what in the hell is this party? Who is this man? He is not talking our language. And so we as Homeland, we're actually starting to pick up a lot of refugees from Reformers saying, you know, we really do need to build something new and something that's going to last, something that's sustainable. And you can only do that by looking at a younger constituency and talking their language. But Reform is very much a boomer party, and it's just increasingly a little bit naff. And so it's hit its high water mark, I think, and we'll start seeing its reach receding.
Where do you say your core geographic constituencies are? Where do you get the most support from?
Well, we're at the moment, we're quite an online party. Curiously, one that's working to build up local branches. So we're dotted all over, and we're not big enough to say that we have strongholds as such. I know that the strongholds tend to come from where you put the most work in, and that tends to depend on who you've got working where. We've got some very dedicated full-time activists, particularly Steve Laws, who is incredibly hardworking, as is Kenny Smith, the party chairman, and they're building up their strongholds locally, and they will become party strongholds, and that's where we'll see the first local results coming in, purely on the back of the hard work. My activism tends to be more online. It's what I'm good at. And I live in the middle of nowhere anyway, so I don't have a local base to build up. So, that's how it's done. It's done with old-fashioned shoe leather, a day at a time. It's as much about embracing the power of social media and we've got a lot of talented social media content producers, but it's as much about old-fashioned politics, meetings in town halls, going out delivering leaflets, setting up the little table in towns and talking to people. This is how it's done. And we're not looking at shortcuts. We're not saying, oh, we're going to be ready and we're going to have parliamentary candidates standing for 2029. It's not going to work like that. You can't build an organization and then backfill it. You've got to build it from the roots. So this is going to take 4 years for the party to become an established campaigning organization, another 4 years to start winning council seats in local politics, possibly another 4 or 5 years to become a national organization, by which time we will be verging on becoming a household name. Whether we actually make a parliamentary breakthrough, I don't know. And I'm not even convinced that it matters, because I was there with UKIP from the very beginning and I watched it grow, and it never actually won a seat in parliament in its own right, but still became one of the most influential Westminster parties of all time, because here we are, we're no longer in the EU. We accomplished what we set out to do. So I've seen that it has been done before. It can be done. I know how it's done. And so if it worked before, it can work again. And so if we're popularizing the idea of homeland over Britain being this neoliberal grazing strip open to all comers, and to say that there is a solution to this, remigration is the solution. You don't have to feel guilty about it. It isn't racist. It is just a pragmatic policy fix to something that should never have been done to us in the first place.
Yeah, let's get into the specifics of that, because in my view, at least, there are people in the UK that just should never have been brought there and should be returned, but they may have acquired UK citizenship, even though they don't think like, you know, the British of old. The stat that always stands out to me is that I think it's in the last 20 years, there more people have migrated to the UK than in the last 1,000 years or 2,000 years.
Something like that.
Incredible. And 12 of those under Conservative Party rule. So I can understand why people are completely fed up with the Conservative, with the Tories. But practically, how do you see remigration working, and what problems do you see involved with that?
Well, I think we've got to first start thinking about the British mentality. We have this idea that once someone comes in legally and they've done it the legal way and they've got a British passport, that can't be undone. It's become this weird thing where people think once you come in, that's it. You got your British citizenship and there's no going back on that. And this is a debate we've got to have, where we've got to ask people why. These people shouldn't have been here in the first place. And just because they've had their paperwork rubber stamped by a dysfunctional home office doesn't mean to say that they are meaningfully British or that they ever can be British. And so that's the first argument that we've got to have, because we've got reform. And it's saying, oh, well, we'll deport anyone who arrived here illegally. So that takes care of the boat people. But that's, you know, what, 50,000 a year. We're talking millions, because we've got 1.2 million illegal immigrants. That's the official statistic. I personally believe it's closer to 2 million. And if you're talking about those who came here legally, well, most of these did. They came in on legal visas and they overstayed the visa and then they disappeared into the woodwork. So you then need to rebuild the detection systems, the local inspection of things like car washes and Turkish barbers and food hygiene inspectors to go and look at takeaways and identify illegal immigration there. So you need to rebuild the civic administration to detect it and deport. And so my issue is just because someone says they've got a British passport that they're British, I don't buy into that at all. And so that is the primary thing that we have to overcome, just because you can get rid of your illegal immigrants, you can get rid of your asylum seekers and bogus refugees, but you're still there's still, I think, probably at least 5 million people who are here who shouldn't be here, who can't integrate, who are never going to contribute economically, who are going to sponge off benefits, and they're going to abuse the system to bring in more of their own people, and it's going to contribute to this sectarianism. So those are the people we've got to remove, whether they've got a British passport or not. So
there's one thing to stop illegal immigration, which you guys, by boat and other means, which you guys haven't been great at. We've been better at that in Australia. There's another thing to cut down the numbers, which we have been not very good at in Australia. And you, I think, Boris Johnson was singing the Australian immigration program as though it was the bee's knees, and it clearly wasn't whatever that election was. And so our numbers are very high. People who have not been born here as a percentage of citizens is over 30% now, which in the UK, I think there was a headline the other day saying that you guys will reach that in 2040 or 2050. Well, we've already reached it. Albeit, you know, the people, some of those are from the UK, some of those are from New Zealand, so it's not quite the same ethnic mix that you have there, but it's still, we are a population of increasingly first-generation migrants, or at least a third are. But how do you focus, the key one is this people that have acquired citizenship. How do you strip them of that citizenship and send them back? And how do you determine which of them can be sent back? Because some of them would have intermarried or will have been, you know, here in some cases for several generations. I mean, that's going to be and would be upstanding citizens, a portion of them, right? And will have contributed. So how do you strip that if that's the way you want to go?
Well, I mean, if you're married into the country, there's no one doing that, and that's not something we would look at. But the core aspect of remigration is that it's voluntary. Mm. So
self-deportation, is that what you're talking about? Like,
yeah, I mean, we're not talking about sending early morning dawn raiders out to bash on people's door and drag them out and send them on a plane home. That's not what we're talking about. If you look at welfare statistics, and particularly allocations of social housing, particularly in London, you will see that a lot of it's going to Somalis, Eritreans, and people from Pakistan, people whose overall contribution to the economy is minimal, who will never be net contributors, and they will use chain migration. They won't marry into Britain. They will bring their own in and marry them. And so this is a process of colonization. Well, we can put a stop to that by saying, you know, if you're foreign born, you're not entitled to housing, you are not entitled to benefits. And so if you cut off the benefits for starters, I think you probably clear out a million that way, because you'd need sort of supplementary measures to put taxes on remittances. And so you take away the attractiveness for Britain to be an economic destination. And certainly if you're on the periphery, cracking down on extremist mosques, which is probably most of them, and you take away translation services. There's a whole package of policies that we put in our remigration policy that creates this hostile environment that encourages emigration. And I think we can do a lot. We can then offer financial incentives. There's a debate as to what level it would need to be in order for it to succeed. But even if we're paying migrants £20,000 or £30,000 to leave, on balance, when you look at how much they would actually cost us in terms of benefits, housing, and crime, and the overall cost of watching our country descend into this low trust, balkanized mess, it's an absolute bargain. So I would personally go into World War II levels of debt to do this policy, because I fundamentally believe it is that necessary. And so I don't believe it has to be jackboots at dawn in order to do this. You've got every right to remove the 2 million illegal immigrants. Then the backlog, you just close down the asylum system and cancel any refuge that's been granted under that. So just within the existing scope, there's approximately 3 million we can get rid of, and through remigration policies, shutting down benefits, etc., I think there's a further 2-3 that can be encouraged to leave. And then we would then take stock, I think, and there'd be a renewed debate as to whether we've done enough. Personally, don't think so, but I'm willing to cross that bridge when we come to it.
Yeah, it's well beyond what the mainstream would consider possible at the moment, right? But what about places like, I mean, I know Bradford because it's in the news, or Rotherham, and all these cases that are cited in the Pakistani, predominantly Pakistani rape scandal in the UK. I mean, what about these towns which are now have representatives of Muslim sectarian parties. That's something we haven't yet got in Australia, although this next federal election might be a little bit interesting. We might be starting to see the start of that here. There certainly is a Muslim Votes organization which is pushing candidates and organizing. But what do you do with those towns, those notorious towns in northern England predominantly, which have changed dramatically culturally and are nothing like what they were 50 years ago? How do you expel people from that if that's what you want to do?
History doesn't have an undo button. I don't see a situation where we would get a reversion to 1945 demographics. Anyone pressing for that, I think, is being wholly unrealistic. And I don't actually think anybody in our party is. Mm-hmm. Some are saying we want a reversion back to, Britain is 95% white British. Mm-hmm. And that seems extreme until you realize that that's roughly where we were in the mid 90s. And most of this has happened since Tony Blair. And to have a staged array of policies with a view to rolling us back to at least 1997, which I think that would take us to around 93-94%. White British. I think that's achievable. I think that's also very fair. The thing is, a lot of the first generation Pakistanis that came in, to an extent, did successfully integrate, but that process has started to go into reverse as you're having more incomers coming into places like Bradford. They can't become British because there's nothing discernibly British for them to integrate into. They can't send their kids to our schools because there's no concept of our schools. They will be Muslim schools dotted all over the city. There's an argument to be had as to how stringent we want to press hard on Islam. There are some who say, it simply does not belong here and Muslims should be encouraged to leave. I happen to believe so, yeah. But not in, we're not talking about knocking down mosques as authoritarian regimes would have it. We want to be saying to people that you've a choice to make here. If you want to live by foreign traditions and dress in according to a different ethnic code, there's plenty of places you can do that, but it's not going to be here. And if you have a problem with that, then not only do you need to go home, we will help you. We will send you on your way. Because what has to be understood is that when this all goes south, all of these ethnic minority groups, they've got somewhere to go back to. We don't. This is our home. Once this is broken, once this is destroyed, there is absolutely nowhere for us to go. And so this is about preserving Britain as a functioning homeland for us. And on the understanding that if something isn't done, then we lose all of it. It degrades into civil war. What we're dealing with is a people who treat Britain as an economic grazing strip. And should we ever say, if we went to war against Russia in a battle over Ukraine, would the Eritreans sign up for the British Army to defend us? No. Would the Somalians? No. Would the Pakistanis? No. Would the Indians? Certainly not. They'd be on the first aeroplane back home. Maybe the West Indians would. Yeah, sure, Londoners would. The actual number of people who see any sense of obligation and loyalty to this country to the extent that they would fight for it, that's just not the case. So I think we have to govern on that basis and say, these people simply are not British. They wouldn't fight for Britain. They don't see us as part of them and vice versa. And that is the basis upon which all future policy making and decision making must be made.
Yeah. And realistically, what are you hoping for by the next British election?
I don't put too much stock into what happens at the next election. I'm not interested in what happens at the next election. I'm interested in what happens in the next 20 years. And what happens in the next 20 years is very much contingent on what we do now, which is why we're starting this new party, which is why we're building it. And there aren't any shortcuts, and everybody's saying, oh, well, it'll be too late by then. My message to people who say, oh, it'll all be over by then, is just get out of my way. I don't want to hear your negativity. Nothing's irreversible. We do have time. And if you're just going to sit there mithering, saying there isn't any time, so there's nothing that you can do, just go and curl up and die, because you're just getting in the way of people who do think something can be done. So I'm interested in growing the party, developing it, and what happens between then, well, we'll take it as it comes.
And have you got established connections with other European parties on the right, the new right? And have they been helpful, or do you have to sort of choose which ones most aligned to you and which don't?
I'm actually not involved in that level of decision making, but the party itself does have connections with AfD and other populist and right-wing movements across Europe. I know that the guys are going over to talk to the French outfit in a couple of weeks. So there's a lot of knowledge exchange and discussion about strategy and tactics. And Kenny Smith's your man to talk to on that, and he'll tell you all about that. That's not something I'm involved with. I'm more on the sort of policy development side. Strategy and politics is best left to those most able and willing.
Sure. No, look, I think it's really valuable to properly articulate the case in a thoughtful way like you do, right? Because you don't want to degenerate into simply... Like, I genuinely fear that these issues, that if they're not addressed in a thoughtful, constructive way with practical policy solutions, it will just result in, you know, hooliganism or kind of...
Yeah.
Ethnic crime, like hatred, and all the sort of terrible, you've mentioned civil war. I noticed there was a podcast recently with Louise Perry where she interviewed a noted academic who's actually a global expert on civil war, and he said it was a real live possibility in the UK, which I think is, it was particularly, I guess, scary coming from him with his mild-mannered sort of tone and thoughtful academic, voice, right? It's useful, very, really useful what you do, and I'll certainly direct everyone to your website and your Twitter handle, because it needs to be handled in the way that you are doing. Konstantin Kissin, the well-known podcaster, he was out in Australia last year, and he sort of said Australia is 10 years behind the UK. And that used to be, when people used to say that, they used to sort of be making fun of Australians, but now it's said as a form of praise and a warning. What would you suggest Australia should do to avoid, if you could roll back the clock 10 years in the UK, what should have been done then that we should be doing now, if indeed we are 10 years behind, which I have question marks about?
Well, this liberal regime, it's run its course, and it's living on borrowed time. Let me just reset this point. What arose from 1945 is this international rules-based order. And what that produced was a generation of liberal internationalist politicians, and that has been the mind virus of our political class across the West, in Britain, New Zealand, Australia, America, Canada, this idea that the nation state and nationalism is actually something distasteful and harmful. And that's what the regime believes. And we started to dismantle that in at Brexit in 2016. But the message didn't land, and our politicians didn't grasp it, and they haven't realized that the liberal order is collapsing around them, that the international rules-based order is collapsing around them. Donald Trump coming back into the White House is basically pouring petrol on that particular bonfire. The whole thing's coming down, and the EU, in a lot of ways, is a dead man walking. It's dead. They just don't know it yet. And that is the same of all these liberal parties. We talk in this country about the uni party because there's no real fundamental difference between Tories, Labour and Liberals. And they're all the same thing. And you find this replicated across the West. And they, unfortunately, short of violently removing them, they've just got to run their course. And that means they're going to cling on to power far longer than they ever should. If we'd had our act together in 2016, we would have had a party like Reform Rate poised to sweep them all off the board and start afresh. And that's what many people believe Boris Johnson was going to do, but he was an establishment figure in an establishment party. And we keep making the same mistakes because we keep trusting the same people. This is one of the reasons why it's so essential to build something from the ground upwards that can replace it, because you can't trust the establishment. They might steal the clothes of populist movements and they might steal the policies while in opposition, but once they get into power, it's business as usual. So you actually have to start building with a view to replacing them. And so if you're 10 years behind, then you've got to consider that as 10 years lead time to start building now. Now is the time to start asserting the arguments, developing the policies, taking the message out, not just into social media, but out onto the streets, forming networks. We've got informal networks in Britain like New Culture Forum. So, you know, start one of those where across the country you can have town hall meetings and pub meetings and politics in the pub, get people to be talking to each other, meeting each other, forming alliances, discussing the options. But you need to get your skates on, basically.
Well, look, I've really appreciated chatting to you, Pete, and I admire your courage, because there's certainly a trend you see online about people leaving the UK, leaving their homeland because it's being taxed too much, or they're, you know, it's all too hard. So it's admirable those who are willing to stay and fight and attempt to build out something and turn back the tide. And I think there's something, you know, we can learn from you here in Australia. And hopefully this discussion also dispels a lot of the nonsense that you hear online about these parties being, you know, odious and hooligans and all the rest of it, because that's clearly not how you've come across. If people want to find out more about yourself or the Homeland Party, I'll put your Twitter and website in. But
thank you.
What's the best way to get in touch, or UK-based people potentially, or Australians in the UK and others who want to find out more about what you're doing?
Well, I would say join the Homeland Party. Somebody will be in touch. This is we're at a scale now where we've got regional organisers, and if you join, you know, you'll have someone contact you, and you'll be brought in to be involved as much as you want to be. Or you can find me at northernvariant.co.uk and subscribe to my Substack. That's where I do a lot of my writing. But of course, I do most of my writing on X, and I respond to most messages, and I try to reply to any intelligent replies to what I put down. So yeah, I'm always up for debate. I'm always contactable. Anywhere you want to get in touch, please do.
Great stuff. Really enjoyed chatting, and look forward to keeping in touch going forward. Thanks, mate. See ya.
Okay. Sure thing. Thank you.